Chapter 35. A welcome of a different sort greeted the Scapa as it sidled up to the dock at Kirkwall, Orkney's capital. Lined up on shore, waiting for the Coast Guard boat to arrive, were a bus, a hearse, and about 24 figures dressed in white hooded contamination suits. Austin stood at the rail of the boat with Captain Bruce. He eyed the welcoming committee and said, "That's either a decontamination team or the latest in British fashion." "From the looks of things, my crew won't be going on shore leave anytime soon," the captain said. "The Scapa and its crew have been quarantined in case you and your friends have left any nasty bugs behind."
"Sorry to cause you all this trouble, Captain."
"Nonsense," Captain Bruce said. "Your visit has certainly enlivened what would have been a routine patrol. And as I say, it's what we do."
Austin shook hands with the captain, then he and the other refugees from the island walked down the gangway. As each passenger set foot on land, he or she was asked to don a clear plastic suit and cap and a surgical mask. Then they were escorted onto the bus and the dead were loaded into the hearse. The passengers were asked not to raise the window blinds. After a ride of 5 minutes, they stepped off the bus and found themselves inside a spacious building that once could have served as a warehouse. A huge bubble tent had been set up inside the building to serve as a decontamination lab, staffed by more people in white suits. Everyone who had been on the island was asked to shower, and their clothes were stuffed in plastic bags and taken off to be analyzed. When they were finished showering, they were given cotton hospital outfits that made them look like mental patients, poked and prodded by a phalanx of plastic-wrapped doctors, and pronounced fit to rejoin the human race. Despite the indignities, they were treated with the utmost politeness. After being examined, Austin and his Numa colleagues were given back their neatly folded and newly laundered clothes. Then they were taken into a small, mostly bare room furnished with several chairs and a table. At their entry, the man in the pinstripe suit who sat behind the table stood and introduced himself as Anthony Mayhew. He said he was with MI5, the British Domestic Intelligence Service, and asked them to take a seat. Mayhew had finely chiseled features and an upper-class accent that led Austin to say, "Oxford?"
"Cambridge, actually," he said with a smile.
Mayhew talked in clipped sentences as if he had taken verbal shears to extraneous words. "Distinction is hard to catch. My apologies for the folderol with the sawbones and those lab people in the spacesuits. Hope you weren't inconvenienced."
"Not at all.
We were badly in need of showers," Austin said.
"Please tell whoever does our laundry to use a little less starch in our collars," Zavala added.
A chuckle escaped Mayhew's thin lips.
"I'll do that. MI5 are well acquainted with the work of Numa's special assignments team, but once the brass heard from Captain Bruce about dead bodies, secret experiments, and mutants, they simply panicked like the good civil servants they are. They wanted to make sure you wouldn't contaminate the British Isles."
Austin grimaced. "I didn't think we smelled that bad."
Mayhew gave him a blank look and then broke into laughter. "American humor. I should have known. I spent several years on assignment in the States. My superiors were less worried about odor than having a deadly virus being unleashed."
"We wouldn't dream of contaminating our English cousins," Austin said.
"Please assure your superiors that this has nothing to do with biological warfare."
"I'll do that as well," Mayhew said. He looked from face to face.
"Please, could someone please explain what the devil is going on?"
Austin turned to Trout. "Paul is in the best position to fill you in on island life. The rest of us were only there for a few hours."
Trout's lips tightened in a wry grin. "Let me start by saying that the island is not exactly a Club Med."
He then laid out the story, from the Alvin's aborted dive on the Lost City to his escape and rescue. Austin expected a snort of disbelief when Trout described his work on the Philosopher's Stone, but instead Mayhew slapped his knee in an un-British display of emotion.
"This fits like a glove. I knew there was something big behind the scientists' deaths."
"I'm afraid you've lost us," Austin said.
"Pardon me. Several months ago, my department was called in to investigate a bizarre series of deaths involving a number of scientists.
The first was a 50-year-old computer expert who went out to his garden tool shed, wrapped bare electrical wires around his chest, stuck a handkerchief in his mouth, and plugged the wires into an outlet. No apparent motive for killing himself. Austin winced. Very creative. That was only the beginning. Another scientist on his way home from a London party drove off a bridge. The police said his blood alcohol level far exceeded the legal level. But witnesses at the party said he had not been drinking, and his relatives said the man never drank anything stronger than port. He'd throw up if he did. On top of that, someone had put old, worn-out tires on his meticulously maintained Rover. "You're starting to interest me," Austin said. "Oh, it gets better." A 35-year-old scientist ran a car filled with gas cans into a brick wall. Apparent suicide, the authorities said. Another chap was found under a bridge. Suicide again, the police said. Evidence of alcohol abuse and depression. Family said he never drank alcohol in his life, out of religious conviction, and that there was no depression. Here's another. Chap in his 20s, ties one end of a nylon cord around his neck, the other end to a tree, gets back in the car and speeds off. Decapitation. How many of these strange deaths did you investigate? Around 24. All scientists. Austin let out a low whistle. What's the connection to the Forbidden Island? None that we knew of at the time. A couple of scientists were Americans, so we had a request from the U.S. Embassy to look into it. Some MPs have asked for a full-scale inquiry. I was told to nose around and given a very small investigative staff, not to make a big thing of it, and report my findings directly to the Prime Minister's office. Sounds as if the brass wasn't anxious to stir things up, Austin said. Exactly my impression, Mayhew said. Talked to the relatives and learned that all the dead men had formerly worked for the same research lab. McLean's former employer? Trout said. That's right. When we couldn't find McLean, we assumed he had met an untimely end or had something to do with the deaths of his colleagues. Now here he turns up on your island, dead, unfortunately, thereby establishing the connection to the lab. Trout leaned forward in his chair. What was the nature of the research? They were supposedly doing research into the human immune system at a facility in France. It was apparently a subsidiary of a larger multinational corporation, but they did a good job of hiding ownership in layer after layer of straw companies, dummy corporations, and overseas bank accounts. We're still trying to trace the line of ownership. And if you do, you'll charge them with murdering those scientists, Austin said. That's the least of it, Mayhew said. From Dr. Trout's account, it seems that the work they were doing created those mutants and condemned them to a living death. Let me sum up what we have so far, Austin said. This lab employs scientists to work on a project to come up with the so-called Philosopher's Stone, an elixir based on ocean enzymes from the Lost City. The scientists are apparently successful in producing a formula that prolongs life, thereby ensuring their own premature deaths. McLean escapes, but is brought back to lead a reconstituted scientific team to correct flaws in the formula. Flaws that produce awful mutations. Paul blunders into their mining operation and is drafted to work in their lab. The pieces fit together like clockwork, Mayhew said. May I ask you a question, Mr. Austin? Why didn't you contact the British authorities immediately with this information? Let me answer that with a question of my own. Would you have believed me if I showed up at your door raving about red-eyed fiends? Absolutely not, Mayhew said. Thanks for being honest. You must know that it would have taken time going through regular channels. We felt that any delay might be fatal. Paul Trout is a friend as well as a colleague. I can understand that. As I said, I'm acquainted with the work of your special assignments team and know you were probably more than up to the task. I had to ask you the question because my superiors would ask it of me. Gemay said, Is anyone in your government going to investigate the island? A naval ship is on its way, Mayhew said. It's carrying a contingent of Royal Marines who will be sent ashore. They'll attempt to find this submarine, seal off the labs, and neutralize the guards and these mutants. From what I saw, I doubt you'll find much left of the guards, Trout said. There was a moment of silence as Trout's words sank in. Then Mayhew said, You had the most experience with these mutants, Dr. Trout. What was your impression? They are savage, cannibalistic, and incredibly strong. They are able to communicate, and judging from their raid on the Outcasts Island, they can plan. He paused, thinking about his encounter with the mutant in the zoo. I don't think their essential human qualities have all been eliminated. Mayhew replied with an enigmatic smile. Fascinating. I think we are done here, but I wonder if you could spare a few more minutes. I have something of interest I'd like to show you. Mayhew led them through a labyrinth of corridors until they came to a chilly room that had been set up as a medical examiner's lab. A plastic sheet covered a form that lay on a metal table illuminated by a spotlight. A middle-aged man in a white lab coat was standing next to the table. Mayhew signaled the man, and he pulled the sheet back to reveal the ravaged face of the red-eyed creature that had been shot aboard their boat. He didn't seem so terrible with his eyes closed. His face had lost its permanent snarl and seemed more in repose. A little rough around the edges, Mayhew said. Not bad-looking, for a Frenchman. Are you displaying your Anglo bias, or do you know for a fact that he's French? Austin said. Mayhew smiled and reached into his pocket, producing a thin metal tab with a chain attached. He handed the object to Austin. This was around this gentleman's neck. It's a little time-worn, but you can read the writing. Austin held the tab under the light and read the words. Pierre Levant, Capitaine, L'Armée de la République de France, born 1885. Looks like our friend here stole someone's dog tag. I had the same thought at first, but the tag actually belongs to this chap. Austin responded with a quizzical look. Mayhew was not smiling as he would if he meant the wild assertion as a joke. That would make him more than 100 years old, Austin said. Close to 120, to be exact. There must be some mistake. How can you be sure this is the man whose name is on the dog tag? Millions of men were lost during World War I. Quite true, but the armies did a tolerably good job of keeping records despite the chaos. Men were often identified by their comrades or officers. As the fighting moved on, bodies were cleared by special units and the director of graves registration took over, aided by the unit chaplain. There were cemetery maps drawn, information filtered through a casualty clearing station, hospitals and grave registrations, and so on. That information has been put on a computer. We learned that there was a Pierre Levant, that he served as an officer in the French army, and that he disappeared in action. A lot of men disappeared in action. Oh, you skeptical Americans, Mayhew said. He reached into his suit and pulled out a pocket watch, which he handed to Austin. We found this in his pocket. He was quite a handsome devil at one time. Austin examined the inscription on the back of the watch. A Pierre de Claudette, avec amour. Then he flipped the watch open. Set into the cover was a picture of a young man and woman. He showed the watch to the other members of the Numa team. What do you think? Gamay examined the tag and the watch. One of the first things I learned in marine archaeology was the importance of establishing provenance. For instance, a Roman coin found in a Connecticut cornfield could mean that a Roman had dropped it, but it's just as likely the source was a colonial-era coin collector. Mayhew sighed. Perhaps Dr. Blair can convince you. Oh, I didn't believe it either, said the white-frocked pathologist. We did an autopsy on the gentleman. The cells in this individual are comparable to those of a man in his late 20s, but the brain sutures, the joints of the skull, indicate the gentleman is... He cleared his throat. More than 100 years old. That would mean the work on the life extension formula goes back much further than we've assumed, Austin said. An incredible yet reasonable assumption, Mayhew said. There were rumors during World War I of attempts to develop a berserker, a super soldier of sorts who would charge enemy trenches in the face of fierce fire. You're thinking that it's related to the life extension research? I don't know, Mayhew said. He drew the sheet back over the creature's face. Poor hombre, Zavala said, glancing at the happy couple in the watch photograph. What a waste of 100 years. We may only have uncovered the tip of the iceberg, Mayhew said. Who knows how many have died to keep this terrible secret? I don't blame them for not advertising failures like the one on that table, Gemme said. It goes beyond that, Mayhew said. Suppose this elixir has been perfected. What kind of a world would we have if some people could live longer than others? A world that will be very much off balance, Gemme ventured. My feelings exactly, but I'm a lowly detective. I'll leave that for the analysts and policymakers to deal with. Do you plan to stay long in the UK? He asked Austin. Probably not, Austin said. We'll talk about our plans and let you know what we decide. I'd appreciate that. Mayhew produced a business card with his name and phone number and handed it to Austin. Please call, night or day. In the meantime, I can't overemphasize the importance of keeping this to yourselves. My report will go only to Dirk Pitt and Rudy Gunn. Fine. I'll let you know what our Marines find on the island. Maybe it will lead to the people behind this thing. Murder? Kidnapping? Hijacking? Slave labor? He mused. Immortality is a potent motive for evil. I'd wager that anyone in this room would sell his firstborn rather than pass up the chance to live forever. Not everyone, said Austin. What do you mean? Given the chance, who wouldn't want to live forever? Austin gestured toward the sheet-draped gurney. Ask the old soldier lying on that table.